Well, good morning, everybody. Am I hot? Cool. Am I good? You hear me? Okay, cool. All right. So I am super excited to see what the Lord has saved for us this morning. And I appreciate, Will, thank you for opening us up. So we're going to continue the journey through John. So what we're going to see today are some events that transpired before Jesus finds himself in front of Caiaphas. So today we're gonna see Peter's first denial. We're gonna see also Jesus's first trial. So let's jump right in. Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and the Jewish officials arrested Jesus. They bound him and brought him in first to Annas, who was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, the high priest that year. Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jewish leaders that it would be good if one man died for the people. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard. But Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" she asked Peter. He replied, "I am not." It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. Meanwhile, the high priests questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. "I have spoken openly to the world," Jesus replied. "I always taught in synagogues or at the temple, where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they would know what I said." When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So there's a lot going on there, right? So we're going to talk first. So this command, so obviously we see quite the outfit coming after Jesus, right? So the commander was the officer in charge, the executive of the Roman garrison. And so they're in Jerusalem. So there's a number of other cross-references that use this same term, commander. So this was serious and strengthens the impression that the Romans supported the action of the Jewish hierarchy. His bounding, as we see, as we read, his bounding also shows that, you know, they regarded him dangerous enough to send many soldiers after him. So in custody, when they bound Jesus, they treated him as an absolute threat. So I don't believe, as we read, I don't believe he surrendered to them. I don't believe that Jesus did surrender to them. I believe in this moment he was surrendering to his Father's will. That's what he was surrendering to. The hands that had healed the sick, the hands that had raised the dead, surely could have broken some ropes, right? That he was bound with. So this was him. This was Jesus submitting to his Father's will, and he remained bound. You know, he didn't try to break the ropes. He didn't try anything. He remained bound. And so what I thought interesting too, as I was reading through John's gospel here, is that Judas was not mentioned. And so I thought, you know, why wasn't Judas mentioned? You know, to me, that seems like an awful important part, right? To me, the image when I closed my eyes and I, you know, kind of walked through what was happening, you know, the Judas coming up and the Judas kiss was always this thing to me. So I wondered why. And, you know, the other gospels obviously all talk about Judas's role. You know, they talk about the kiss. In researching, you know, I'm just curious of what others' take might have been on that. And so there's a few takes on why perhaps John didn't message mentioned Judas. So there's focus, you know, so John was maybe focusing more on the themes than the specific details of that event. There was, you know, there was an audience element to this. So John may have been writing to those that were already aware or that already familiar with the story from the other gospels. And then there's perspective. So John may have been presenting the scene, you know, from the bystanders' point of view, who may have not known the reason for the arrest. So I think one thing we can appreciate is what the text says and what it doesn't say. So we don't have to imply anything. The text just doesn't mention it, and I think this is something actually that we were talking about the last time I was up here is, you know, just because it doesn't say it, you just have to accept that it just doesn't say it. And that's okay. And so I just thought it was, you know, there again, just an interesting, why didn't John, you know, John mention that? So we see him brought first to Annas. Just like the Judas omission, John is also the only gospel scene that mentions this interaction with Annas at all. So the other gospels do not mention that. So I asked myself, why? why is that? You know, the best explanation that I found was that perhaps, you know, John did have access to additional details about the event, about what was happening. And he was focusing on maybe a specific aspect of this trial process. So then that caused me to, you know, kind of ask myself the question, so who is Annas? So Annas was the former high priest. Obviously, as we read there, he's the father-in-law of Caiaphas. So he was the high priest that, you know, was not only the religious leader but also a political figure, often interacting with Roman authorities. You see that the bullet point here on the patriarch, you know, so. He was a patriarch of a priestly dynasty, in addition to being the leading benefactor of the scheme to, you know, for temple tax and sacrificial sales. He was notorious, you know, for being a skilled slanderer and a seasoned accuser. So he was not a nice guy. Several of his sons also served as high priests, indicating that the family's substantial control over the religious leaders. But at any rate, the Lord was led to Annas first. And I feel sure that there was a motive there for that act. If you dig into a little bit more about Annas, you get the sense that he had some priority within the peer group that was against Jesus. Some of the other words used to describe him was malignant and cruel and unfair, that he was premier amongst the ministry of persecutors of Jesus. The Talmud, which is the central text of the Rabbinic Judaism and the primary source of Jewish law, there's a passage there that says, you know, woe to the house of Annas. Woe to their serpents hiss. They are high priests. Their sons are keepers of the treasury. Their sons-in-law are guardians of the temple. And their servants beat the people with staves. Annas and his household were notorious. So we're dealing with some not good people here. So this guy was not good. And, you know, a little bit about Caiaphas. So Caiaphas was the current high priest. He had previously suggested that Jesus' death was necessary for the survival of the nation. And we see that in John 45 through 53, which I'll read here for us. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary had seen what Jesus did, believed in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin. What are we accomplishing? They asked. Here is this man performing many signs. If we have let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and they will take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them named Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for the nation, but also for the scattered children of God, to bring them together and to make them one. So from that day, they plotted to take his life. So Caiaphas, as I just read, you know, so Caiaphas did not say, you know, let him be silenced or imprisoned or banished. Those would all have been appropriate, I guess you could say, punishments, or it's, you know, kind of sufficient, you know, to restrain someone. But no, they thought dangerous enough that he said, no, it doesn't need to be those things. He must die. And so he went there. In that unknowing prophecy that Caiaphas spoke, he did speak it logically, that the good of many, you know, outweigh the good of one. But obviously his prophecy was not moral either, but, you know, because it was wrong, and it was wrong to put an innocent man, in this case, the Messiah, to death. So Caiaphas, you know, was definitely a cynical politician. So I was wondering, I kind of stumbled upon this question in research, you know, was it malice against Jesus or was it an absolute desire for stability? So there's a few, you know, mix of motives kind of going on here. There's a threat of authority, political concerns, religious disagreement. So I thought I'd kind of read through some of these that I stumbled upon here. From an authority perspective, you know, Jesus' focus on direct relationship with God and his criticism of religious hypocrisy, you know, could have been seen as undermining the authority of the temple establishment. You know, Caiaphas, as the high priest, might have felt his own power and influence challenged and viewed Jesus as an instigator. So Jesus challenged the hierarchy's interpretation of Sabbath laws, and, you know, we obviously know that, you know, he drove the merchants and the money changers out of the temple, declaring that they had made it into a cave of robbers. We saw that in Luke. Some historians believe that those temple markets were owned by the house of Annas. So perhaps, you know, another reason why Caiaphas is trying to protect that, trying to silence Jesus in this situation. Political concerns. So obviously the growing crowds around Jesus worried the Jewish leaders. So they feared the Roman intervention, right? They feared Jesus. He perceived him as a political rebel. Caiaphas, concerned about maintaining stability, might have viewed Jesus' elimination as a way of appeasing the Romans. Like, there's too much noise going on. We got to get rid of this. Got to get rid of this guy, this rebel rouser. Then there's the religious disagreement. So beyond political considerations, Caiaphas might have genuinely disagreed with Jesus' teaching. The Sadducees, the priestly class to which Caiaphas likely belonged, you know, they differed from the Pharisees in interpretations of some scriptures and the afterlife. So we're gonna shift gears. So let's check in on Peter and John. So I'll read this section of scripture again. So Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. So, you know, Peter, you know, did embarrass himself in the garden. He had the sword. He lopped off the ear of the high priest servant. So, you know, Peter, you know, hoping for a second chance to show his loyalty, follows Jesus to where he was being held. Now, most believe that this second disciple, this other disciple, was John himself, who had previous connections to the high priest and his household. John's connection there to the high priest and his servants explains how Peter and John had any access whatsoever to the courtyard on this night, on such a night, because obviously we've got all this going on. You know, we've got Jesus now being brought in. This is kind of a secret trial happening at night, which we'll get to here in a minute. But John's connection, you know, we can kind of say that that's probably the only reason that why they were even allowed into the courtyard. So Peter's denial, "You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you?" she asked Peter. He replied, "I am not." It was cold, and the servants and officials stood around a fire they had made to keep warm. Peter also was standing with them, warming himself. So we see this, as mentioned in this translation, a simple servant girl who minded the door to the courtyard of the high priest's house, you know, kind of questioning Peter. So on the surface, this could seem like a super easy test for Peter, right? You've got this simple servant girl, a simple test for his loyalty. He could have answered nothing. He could have mumbled something. He could have said, "I am not." But he didn't. And then you see this, you know, the two here. In other translations, the word "also" is used. It means that if John was the other disciple, that that John was already known to her as a disciple of Jesus. The servant girl, presumably, you know, knowing that the other disciple to be a follower of Jesus, and when she saw him bringing in Peter, you know, she can kind of say, "Oh no, you know, kind of not another one, right? So here comes another one, following Jesus." So, but we see Peter respond to her negative statement, you know, with a negative of his own. So instead of being loyal to Jesus, he denied being his disciple. This all kind of seems to have happened, you know, at the door, perhaps a quick exchange. Maybe Peter was caught off guard. Maybe it was just a quick response. But even so, it was yet a quick and an obvious denial of association with Jesus. There's a sense that, well, we see Peter, you know, kind of going to warm himself. The sense is that Peter was there, you know, by the fire, not only because it was cold and he wanted warmth, but he also, at this point, you know, kind of wanted to blend in and not stand out. He didn't want to be noticed. Because of everything that was transpiring and it was about to transpire, it would have been dangerous, you know, to kind of be noticed, right? So he was a disciple of the man that was being arrested and in serious trouble. But through this denial, Peter had just distanced himself spiritually, you know, from the Lord. But we see him turn to an earthly means to warm himself. And so, as well as, you know, he's taken now in the presence of those associated with the high priest, but the physical coldness of this scene reflects Peter's spiritual struggle, right? So there's an absolute relatability there for us that, you know, in this world, you know, facing struggles and being distanced from the Lord, that some are, you know, some do turn to those earthly vices to bring warmth and to bring comfort. So Peter was now distanced himself from the Lord where he had warmth and comfort. He denied him. Now we find Peter by the fire, right? But as we know, you know, all those earthly things are subject to elements, and their comforts will not last. This courtyard is also an interesting setting for this story. That it represents a place of his faith being tested, a place of judgment and power. This location, it definitely provides a dramatic backdrop for Peter's denial. It emphasizes the gravity of the situation. You know, only those that had connections could enter. The high priest, you know, of residence was well guarded, was a well guarded complex. And it was a place where legal and religious matters, you know, often were discussed and decided. But Jesus being brought here, you know, kind of symbolizes, you know, the beginning of his trials, and leading to, and also the religious leaders' active role, leading up to Jesus' crucifixion. In this in this tense scene, you know, we see Peter go from a declaration of loyalty that we heard in John 13:37, where Peter asked, Lord, why can't I follow you now? I will lay down my life for you. And then from that to now, in this denial, while Jesus is, you know, standing strong in the face of unjust accusations, you know, we see Peter falter here. And so I think it's also interesting that the, you know, these kind of two narratives, Peter and Jesus, you know, really highlight, you know, Jesus's fulfillment of his mission and then Peter's human frailty, right? But as we know, there is also a redemption story, you know, being constructed here. Peter will go on to deny Jesus three times. Jesus will go on to be crucified, but God is merciful, and he's using this dark moment in Peter's life to teach him forgiveness, to teach him humility. You know, it was the Father's compassion that showed Peter how to be compassionate, and the Lord's faithfulness to him, even when he was unfaithful, that demonstrated him to how to show true faith to others. You know, the other Gospels go into a little bit more, I guess you can say, detail about Peter's emotional and kind of psychological state and the pressure that he was facing. So in Mark provides additional details about the trial, Peter's denial, you know, emphasizing that emotional turmoil that Peter was experiencing. Matthew similarly describes the setting and the events, focusing on Peter's fear and the weeping after realizing his denial. Luke highlights the moment that Jesus turns to Peter after his third denial, and just, you know, there again, closing my eyes and, you know, looking, you know, just kind of picturing that, right? Jesus, after the third denial, Jesus like literally turning him and looking at Peter. And that's when that's that powerful moment that, you know, the realization and the remorse that Peter felt in that moment. So I think, you know, we can all relate to those experiences of, you know, in this situation with Peter, not standing up for his faith, you know, not, you know, and going through that, going through denial. Meanwhile, the high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and his teaching. I have spoken openly to the world, Jesus replied. I always taught in synagogues or at the temple where all the Jews come together. I said nothing in secret. Why question me? Ask those who heard me. Surely they know what I said. So, Annas, wanted to know about Jesus' disciples, perhaps because of fear or jealousy, but then he also wanted to know about his doctrine. He wanted to know what Jesus taught that might be of concern, you know, kind of to the religious establishment. So Annas basically brought the prisoner in and asked him, you know, tell us what you're guilty of and everyone who is with you. So that's what basically Annas is doing in this situation. So in his reply, Jesus did not mention his disciples at all. He protected them in every way possible. So Jesus in this exchange here politely explained to Annas that he had nothing to hide. The things he said, he had spoken openly in the to the world. None of his teachings were in secret. And the things he taught were always in public, such as the synagogues and the temple. Jesus was not in this situation here. He was not obligated to respond to his interrogators' questions, but he respectfully answered them anyways. Instead of taking the bait, Jesus answered, "You know, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, as I spoke nothing in secret." So, you know, why are you asking me? So in saying this, and obviously he says in this particular translation, why question me? So in saying this, Jesus wasn't being uncooperative. He was only asserting his legal right. He knew the rules, he knew the laws. There was to be no formal charge against the accused until witnesses had been heard and had been found to have truth. So this was not a fair trial for a multitude of reasons, which we'll get to here in a second. It was the high priest's duty to call forth witnesses. There were proceedings that they were supposed to be following, beginning with those for the defense, in this case, Jesus. These basic legal protections for the accused under the Jewish law were not observed in the trial. Jesus, therefore, was claiming that if the teaching was in question, evidence should be heard in a normal way, right? So all the rules were broken in regards to a fair trial in this situation. And I've put up a few of those rules here, and I think there's a link in the sheet there that explains all the rules. I forget how many there were, 15 or 20. But I put up just a few here. But you know, the primary, you know, it's clear that they provided, you know, some examples, but you know, the other thing, you know, is, you know, Jesus, you know, was civilly exercising his rights in according to this Jewish law. Jesus was requesting Annas to provide witnesses and present evidence, and he was, you know, legally required to do that before arresting and interrogating him. But throughout his religious trial, you know, the Bible gives no indication that anyone ever came to the defense of Jesus. In fact, it suggests in Mark 14:64 here, it suggests that they were all against him. So the high priest tore his clothes, which is also another rule that was broken. The high priests were not supposed to tear their clothes. Why do you need any more witnesses? He asked. You have been heard. You have heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. So they already had all made up their minds that he was guilty. When Jesus said this, one of the officials nearby slapped him in the face. "Is this the way you answer the high priest?" he demanded. "If I said something wrong," Jesus replied, "testify as to what is wrong. But if I spoke the truth, why did you strike me?" Then Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. So it was definitely, and this is another rule, I forget if it was on that previous page or not, but it was definitely inappropriate for one of the officers to strike a prisoner for speaking wrongly. According to Jewish law, the prisoners were to be treated fairly and humanely, you know, by those who judged him. You know, this anonymous official here began the physical abuse of Jesus that would obviously end in his crucifixion. In his deity, Jesus knew this man's name, the striker, that is. But as the one of the, but this man that struck Jesus, as one of those who did not know, you know, what they did against the Messiah, his name was graciously not recorded in this particular scripture. However, his crime was, just as we just read. So this blow was a signal for the indignities that were about to occur. This subordinate or attendant of the former high priest that struck Jesus on the high priest's behalf, despite Jesus' respectful response, the officer offended that a humble prisoner like Jesus would have, you know, the audacity to request someone as revered as Annas to follow the rules, right? So the irony here is that, you know, in this violent reaction, that the officer just struck the, you know, he had just struck the high priest. As the Messiah, Jesus was supreme high priest in the order of Melchizedek. The officer unwittingly fulfilled the prophecy that Isaiah wrote. We ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. You see Jesus here, you know, kind of looking for justification. Jesus asked both the unnamed official and Annas to justify this physical abuse. Jesus exposed the shameful truth that they did not follow their own standards, their own rules, their own practices of judgment. But he mercifully did not respond in kind, according to this officer's actions. And instead of punishing him, you know, probably as he deserved, for striking a person of God, the man of God, Jesus offered a gentle rebuke. So Annas wanted to know what Jesus' teaching was, and he definitely got a beautiful front row seat, front row display of that teaching through Jesus' merciful response to this officer. But Annas, you know, was not interested in such things, you know, especially at this late hour. The former high priest only wanted really to discover something that something about Jesus that he could twist into an accusation that would be sufficient, you know, to murder him. So Annas' attempt was absolutely, you know, unsuccessful. Jesus had responded correctly to this tense situation. He did so with the utmost patience and respect and love for Annas and his officer, both of whom bore his divine image, as it says in Genesis, and were his personal creations, although fearfully, and you know, they were fearfully and wonderfully made, Psalm 139:14. It was apparent that Annas and his officers, you know, hated Jesus. They were looking there again. They were looking for something to twist. They were looking for a reaction out of Jesus. They regarded him as their enemy, but Jesus' merciful response to their hatred was an application of his teachings to his disciples. And a few of those, you know, kind of listed here. You know, do not resist an evil person. You know, turn the other cheek. He was slapped. He did not respond physically. Loving your enemies, as Matthew and Luke note, and then being merciful, just as your Father is merciful. You know, and so what we see at the end here is, you know, unable to find, you know, anything sufficient during this dark purpose. Annas decided it was time to move Jesus along and concluded this preliminary trial. I also went back and looked, and there was, you know, there was no mention of Jesus ever being unbound throughout this entire ordeal. So all the way from his arrest, all the way through this, you know, Jesus was never said that he was unbound. So he remained completely restrained, you know, physically and according to his Father's will during this whole exchange here. and at the end, so Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest, for his second religious trial, which we will hear more about, and that's where Pastor Allen will pick it up next week. So I should have told you all in the beginning, I was trying to get done around about 9:45 because I had a flight to get to, so I didn't mean to rush us along. I see 9:44 back there, and I did not think it was that well planned, but the Lord helped with execution today. So. But I mean, I've got a few minutes. I'm happy to have some dialogue. If I do have an answer key up here, like I said, I know I was going a little bit fast. And after I printed these out this morning, I realized that the font point is a little small for writing. Not everybody writes small. So I apologize if it was a little difficult to keep track this morning, but thank you. Will?
At the beginning, you mentioned that, I think I know what you meant by Jesus was not being was not mentioned.
Yeah.
You're mentioning in that passage, Judas is mentioned, but
the kiss. That's probably more precise. Yeah, the kiss.
Story of Judas's betrayal.
Yeah, in John.
Just not that.
Yeah, not that moment. That's what I meant. Really, just not that moment, which to me is, I don't know, like I said, I've always just kind of pictured that happening and Judas walking up and that's the one I kiss. And so, yeah, I just thought it was, yeah, that's what I meant. All right. Well, thank you. Like I said, I was trying to end early, so I guess you have a few more minutes now to meander about, to grab a coffee or what have you before second service. So thank you guys for sticking with me this morning. Thank you guys for being an awesome kind of group to be in front of. So I appreciate it. Thank you.